You're listening to Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The COVID-19 pandemic has turned Southern California upside down, but not all of the changes to daily life are bad news.
It is the one area of benefit, if you will, from this terrible virus is a 23% reduction in crime here in Los Angeles over this past month.
Local law enforcement leaders such as LAPD Chief Michael Moore and LA County Sheriff Alex Villanueva have said that crime has plummeted at unprecedented rates.
Property crime down 15% and calls for service down 12%.
Pretty much every kind of crime, robbery, rape, burglary, petty theft, assault, murder, arson, all down. Although there are concerns that violence at home may be on the rise. Overall, arrests in the city of Los Angeles are down more than 30% from last month. Violent and property crimes in 2020 are down more than 10% from this time last year. It's one of the safest times in LA's recorded history.
Criminal homicide down 31%. Rape down 34%. These are very large statistical shifts.
Why? Well, LAPD Assistant Chief Robert Arcos says the short answer is even criminals don't want to go outside right now.
For crime, you know, you need a location and activity, and then you need a victim and a suspect. And at least three of those four factors are fairly removed if they're following the safer at home order, right?
But you and everyone else can't stay home forever. So what happens when you go back outside, when houses are left empty again during the day, or when you walk to the bus stop alone after work at night? More on that story now. And KCRW's Kaylee Wells.
LAPD Assistant Chief Arcos has been on the force for 32 years. He says he's never seen crime plummet this quickly. But it's not the first time crime dropped overnight.
So I came on in 1988. I'm scanning back in my years of the department, and the only two other times that I feel that we were probably close to something like this was during the riots when we had the curfews. And probably during the earthquake.
Arcos is referring back to the 1992 unrest across the city after a jury acquitted police who were videotaped beating motorist Rodney King. The day after the violence began, law enforcement implemented a curfew, confining residents to their homes from dusk to dawn. They stayed home, and crime rates tanked. Fast forward 21 months.
The freeway just completely buckled. I mean, it was just horrendous.
When a 6.7 earthquake struck Northridge, killing 57 people and causing billions of dollars in property damage, roads were impassable, including the 10 freeway. And again, people stayed home. And when people stay home, it's a lot harder to find someone on the street to rob or to burgle a house while everyone is inside all day. Which also accounts for why the only property crime that is increasing is car thefts. Because they're being left on curbs for days without the owners there to notice they're being stolen. Also, the data show that crimes by repeat offenders are going up since California issued a statewide $0 bail to keep crowds in jails down amidst the coronavirus pandemic. USC Business Economics professor Aisha Imrohorolu says the overall drop in crime might seem surprising at first glance.
You need to think about the economic situation surrounding, say, the recession. People lose their jobs, they're more unemployed, so you might think that could cause higher crime.
Typically, as they increase, the crime rates do too. But the unemployment rate now is at a historic high, yet crime is down. And the last time millions of people lost jobs so fast, the Great Recession of 2008, the same thing happened. In fact, from the mid-2000s to 2014, crime decreased overall every year. Joan Renner is an expert in the history of crime in Los Angeles. She says to understand that, we have to go back further to the Great Depression.
The crime rate was actually spectacularly high in the early part of the 30s.
In 1933, one in four working Americans couldn't find a job. That's the highest unemployment rate the country has ever seen.
The Depression, crime soared for the first few years of it. After the stock market crash in October 1929, till probably about mid-1934, it just started to go up. And it was just up, 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 up. That was the trajectory.
But then social programs started to kick in, and the trajectory changed. Programs like the first gun control law that passed in 1934. and FDR's New Deal that provided financial relief, jobs, government support that didn't exist before. So by the time 2008 rolls around, there are safeguards in place to stop crime from spiking again. Here's Imraho Rolu.
So say, for example, if we have a good unemployment insurance scheme, then their incentives to commit crimes is going to be reduced because if they were caught, they would also lose the unemployment insurance.
Renner says better home security was also being developed in the 2000s, and it was a different police force than in 1934.
In 2008, with the recession, one of the reasons crime, I think, went down, more criminals were actually in jail at that time. The police had developed better tactics for finding and controlling crime. They were doing a lot of what was known as hotspot policing.
That's when you station officers in an area of high crime. And this time around, police are increasing their presence again. At the beginning of the stay-at-home orders, LAPD announced they were putting another 300 officers on patrol. There's more police in places where people are gathering, like Costco and grocery stores. The pandemic has already lasted longer than the 1992 curfew and the first impact of the 1994 earthquake. And the economic consequences are more dramatic than the 2008 recession. But Renner says the effect on crime is the same.
The reason for it is unprecedented, but the way people behave in a crisis situation like this or at some major economic downturn like what happened in 2008, the recession, I think that stays kind of similar.
Which also means the return to normal could come with a return to more normal crime rates, too. LAPD Chief Arco says he's cautiously optimistic that the crime won't return to pre-COVID levels. But when people go outside again, an increase is inevitable.
I'm always hopeful that people will change. I am hoping with the silver lining that there'll be so much appreciation and gratefulness across this city and county that when it's lifted, the majority of people will be just grateful to be back out, you know, working and being back out and being able to do things that we won't see a spike. I know that in time, though, we will start to level off again. You know, it's predictable.
Imraho Rolu says one positive difference this time around, crime rates are usually highest among young adults. And those are the kind of people that will be needed as we begin to lift stay-at-home orders.
If there were to be a positive impact of this crisis on youth unemployment going forward, so suppose we do more deliveries from now on in the future, you know, and maybe we use the youth much more as a result, so their unemployment rate goes down. That could have a lasting impact on crime going forward.
Plus, if working from home does become more widely accepted after the pandemic and homes are empty less often, that could mean crime rates change permanently for the better. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, whatever you want to call it, it's going to do what viruses do, and that's spread among hosts. Now, you can stay home, distance yourself, wear a mask to mitigate that, but barring a cure, a treatment, or a vaccine, this is where we are at the moment. Enter Big Pharma and biotech. Southern California is home to a lot of biomedical research and is likely to play a role, maybe even a big role, in the work being done. One of the big ones is Amgen, with offices around the world, but headquartered in Thousand Oaks and thousands of employees there. Dr. David Reese is the Executive Vice President of Research and Development at Amgen, and he's with us right now. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
A lot of folks are working from home these days. I'm working from home. I imagine it's kind of tough, though, to do biomedical or biopharmaceutical research at your dining room table. So Are your labs still full of people over there in Thousand Oaks?
We do have some laboratories, I would say not full of people, because we're maintaining the appropriate social distancing and, of course, protective gear for any of our scientists working in the laboratories. But we do have laboratory activities underway. And, of course, we manufacture a lot of very important drugs, and those manufacturing plants are up and running full steam around the world.
I know getting into the details of the research that you're doing could quickly take us down a scientific rabbit hole, right? With a lot of terminology and jargon that most of us probably aren't ready for. But in layman's terms, you're focusing your research on antibodies. Is that right?
That's correct. Antibodies are natural proteins that your immune system produces to help clear an infection. And what we're doing here is taking B cells, those are cells in your immune system that are little antibody factories, we're taking those B cells from patients who have recovered from COVID-19, and out of the millions and millions of antibody-producing B cells in an individual, trying to isolate those that are going to produce effective or neutralizing antibodies against the virus. We can then manufacture those antibodies at scale as a treatment.
Where are you getting those cells from recovered COVID patients?
These are patients who have volunteered to take part in this research. And so basically they need to donate a tube or two of blood and we isolate the cells from there.
I want to get back to the antibodies again, the factories, right? The you said they're B cells.
Mm-hmm.
Pitched at this level of my forgotten high school chemistry, which I didn't do very well in. What are you doing to develop the ways to get those antibodies to fight or diffuse this virus?
Think of it as a scouting trip, just the way a coach is going to scout high school basketball players across the country. We want to scout those B cells, and through a series of computer algorithms and laboratory experiments, attempt to identify the B cells that are producing antibodies that are effective against the virus. So it's a sort of intensive technical scouting expedition.
I also read that you are perhaps using Otezla in some of this, maybe as a therapeutic. Otezla, I think you acquired last year from another big pharma company. Is that correct?
That's correct. Otezla is a drug that through a complex mechanism has effects on the immune system. It actually acts as an anti-inflammatory, and it's approved for use in psoriasis and the arthritis that's somewhat sometimes associated with psoriasis. In some patients with COVID-19, there appears to be an over-exuberant immune response, a widespread inflammation, particularly in the lungs. And one of our hopes with Otezla is that as an anti-inflammatory, it might reduce that inflammation and improve the outcome for these patients. So we anticipate introducing it into clinical trials in the coming weeks for very close and controlled investigation.
Where's all the funding coming from? You're a big company, obviously. You sell a lot of pharmaceuticals around the world. Where's the funding coming for the research that you're doing?
The research that we're doing against COVID-19, we are funding. We really view this as an all-hands-on-deck moment for industry, academia, and governments. We feel, given our skills and experience, this is our side of the social contract, and we want to take a shot at really helping improve outcomes in this disease.
I know you're doing some great things, and pharmaceuticals, obviously there are treatments for many, many maladies. You guys also get a bad rap for profiteering, I think. I assume part of the intense drive to find a vaccine or a treatment, a therapeutic, is money, right? Is the opportunity to sell it, right, worldwide. If your research is successful and you do find an effective treatment or, dare I say, a vaccine, wouldn't that be wonderful? Would it mean a gigantic windfall for Amgen? I mean, that's obviously the goal, right?
I view this as part of our social contract. We didn't enter into this research out of a profit motive. And we would certainly be committed to doing everything we could to make any therapeutic that emanated from this research available and affordable to the widest range of patients possible around the globe.
What do you say to somebody who's listening to this, doctor, who says, I'm so concerned about this. I feel like there's no end in sight. I'm getting restless at home. I don't, everyone says, Dr. Fauci says it could be a year and a half before any vaccine, if there even is a vaccine. We're not sure about any therapeutics. We've heard about, remdesivir, and we've heard about hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine and all these other drugs that may or may not work. And I'm really getting depressed about this. What do you tell people about the possibility of something coming down the line to make it better?
Well, I think I would tell them two things. One, this will end. There will be a natural end. We will figure it out. And I'm also very optimistic that we will make progress. Each day, we're learning more and more about the virus. And I'm quite confident that effective therapeutics will come along the line. We'll hope that we get a vaccine. We'll see how that research plays out. But each day, we're making progress. And, our understanding is going to really deepen over time, and it's happening in weeks and months now, not years. So there's light at the end of the tunnel. There's no question about it.
We're also learning about this disease that there are mutations of the novel coronavirus, different strains, right? Some more virulent than others, a more contagious strain perhaps, that has spread from Europe to the United States as well, mutations. Does that concern you?
Well, that's something that we're working very hard to understand. And through the genetics work we're doing, we're actually tracing the evolution of the virus to understand if there really are strains that are more infectious or more virulent. Understanding that has tremendous public health implications in terms of recommendations that you make for reopening, relocking down areas. And again, all of that, is a work in progress, but I think we're learning very quickly. One of the hopeful things is that coronaviruses in general, while they do mutate, they don't tend to become particularly more virulent. And most of the mutations we think will not make them resistant to therapies.
That's good news. Knock wood. Again, it's a sea of, it seems like, bad news, but I know you guys are doing the work to try and get us somewhere where we can at least get a control of this and perhaps even a cure. I want to thank you, Dr. David Reese, Executive Vice President of Research and Development at Amgen here in Southern California. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. LA's homeless population is one of the most at risk during the COVID-19 pandemic. A recent study estimates that homeless people are twice as likely to be hospitalized and 2 to 4 times more likely to die due to the novel coronavirus. So last month, Governor Newsom announced the start of something called Project Room Key. The idea is that some of those empty hotel rooms across the state can be used to temporarily house homeless people, particularly at risk. And for its part, Los Angeles County set a goal of housing 15,000 homeless people in hotel rooms, but so far has come up way short. Alyssa Walker is urbanism editor at Curbed LA, and she regularly joins us on Greater LA. Hi, Alyssa.
Hello, Steve.
So, tourism is practically non-existent these days in LA. There are thousands of empty hotel rooms, so the thought was, we have a lot of hotel rooms, ergo we can allow some unhoused people to be housed.
Yes, it seems like a great idea. We always are looking for places to shelter our homeless residents. We're having trouble building the capacity when it comes to permanent housing, so this seems like a great solution. But there's kind of a complicated process here. One is the hotels must volunteer their rooms, and then the county has to negotiate what's essentially like a short-term lease. These are like 90-day leases. And all this takes time, which is why many advocates, including some of the public interest lawyers I spoke to, are really advocating for the mayor to use his emergency powers to commandeer the hotels and really get those room numbers up really high instead of just asking nicely.
So how many people are we talking about? How many unhoused people are in these hotel rooms?
So the goal, as you said before, is 15,000 rooms, and that's what the county has promised. As of last night, there's a really great Twitter account called @RoomKeyTracker, which is posting the latest data. And there are right now 1,517 hotel rooms that are occupied by homeless people.
This program isn't necessarily open to all of the homeless population in LA, though, right? I mean, who goes to the top of the list?
Yes, the goal here is to make it preventative, this program preventative. So the county's most vulnerable residents are prioritized. If you're over 65 or if you have an underlying medical condition that puts you more at risk for contracting one of these very serious cases of COVID-19, you would be given a room first.
Let's listen, Alyssa, to what Mayor Garcetti said last week about this program.
There is plenty of capacity. And I would say to that individual who's experiencing homelessness, who wants to go in, we have a room for you tonight. And we want to house you.
All right. That was Garcetti last week. Is that accurate? It doesn't seem like it's accurate, especially if only 10% are in those rooms as we speak. A homeless person can't just walk up to a hotel and get a room, can they?
Right. I think there's a lot of confusion, especially among people who could benefit most from this program. A lot of the people I talked to who were unhoused had heard about Project Room Key, knew this was happening, heard that number, 15,000 rooms are being secured, and thought they might be eligible, but didn't know how to sign up or how to get more information. All the outreach is being done through service providers, the people who have been working in these neighborhoods. They know who needs help. They know, you know, who is most vulnerable and who they could get on these lists to get in there. You can't just go to a website and your name. You can't just show up at a hotel. The county is not releasing the names of the hotels because they don't want people to just come up and, you know, show up at the hotel who might be turned away.
Who is paying for all of this? Is this the state? Is this the federal government?
So the federal government through FEMA, through like emergency funds, has made this money available, and it's meant to cover about 75% of the cost. Because again, it's like housing people in a preventative way to make sure that we don't have an increase in hospitalizations. We don't want to put more stress on our hospital, healthcare and hospital system. But there's some hope that a subsequent stimulus money would go directly to the cities. We're asking, Mayor Garcetti is part of a coalition of leaders from all over the country that are asking the government for some specific and more direct assistance that would fund this effort additionally.
And, you know, again, these hotels aren't making much money because a lot of people aren't staying in hotels. The hotel staff isn't getting a whole lot of work, right? So this is a way to sort of plug that hole at the moment.
Exactly. I mean, that's the one part of it that really doesn't make too much of sense of why hotels would be super resistant. I'm sure they have other issues. Some of them have claimed that they have insurance issues, but they're literally making no money right now, and their staffs are making no money right now. So what the city and the county is able to negotiate is, you know, a lower rate. It's lower than they probably would be making during the high tourism times. The leases are about $80 to $90 a night, maybe a little bit more. And that's a little bit of money, at least, that can go back to the people who work for them. The service workers are a large group of our population here in LA who are ready to go back to work. And they are people who don't often make that much money. So we want to make sure that we can get people back to work in the professions that they have.
How long is this likely to continue, Alyssa? I mean, what's the plan for people who are in these hotels? What happens to them once the pandemic is over? Do they just go back to being unsheltered, unhoused?
Well, the mayor himself has said that the plan is to make sure that people who come inside during the pandemic are never going back on the streets again. And a lot of the caseworkers I spoke to said that even just 90 days in a hotel gives them a lot of time to get people the help they need. It could get them set up with, say, Section 8 vouchers to get them rental assistance. It could solve a lot of their medical problems. You can make sure that people are getting fed and healthy and making sure that they have a place to go when this is over. So let's get as many people as we can into these safe environments. Let's give ourselves the time to make sure that everybody's needs are met. And then we can see how we can move forward from this and maybe have a better outcome when it comes to housing our homeless population later.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed LA and our regular contributor. As always, Alyssa, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's all the time we have for today. We are in the final throes of KCRW's Mission Critical fundraiser, an UnDrive for the Ages, because we're not interrupting any programming to do it, and that allows us to provide you the news and the culture and the music that you rely on and love about KCRW. Today we have this special anonymous challenge grant, $50,000. If we can get to that amount tonight, your contribution will be tripled. That means $20 becomes $60. It's an important thing to do. KCRW.com/give. And thank you for your support of KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks for your ears and time. And have a great day.